You're listening to The Bar K's on Massive Music Weekend. This is Sean Watson. Tune into my show on Tuesdays, 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Going to have some replays and bonus tracks then. But for now, you're listening to The Bar K's here on Massive Music Weekend, WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Violent crime was up under Donald Trump. That's not even counting the crimes he committed.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz takes the stage as Kamala Harris's Democratic vice presidential candidate. We'll look at Walz's record with Jacobin reporter Bronco Marchetich. And we'll look at where the uncommitted movement stands with Asma Muhammad, campaign manager for Vote Uncommitted Minnesota. We'll also speak with Jeremy Scahill of Drop Site News about his new report, Something Came from the Outside, an eyewitness account of the aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's assassination. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris campaigned in Philadelphia Tuesday with Tim Walz just hours after Harris named the Minnesota governor as her running mate. Before an audience of more than 12,000 people at Temple University, Governor Walz criticized his Republican rivals, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
I got to tell you, pointing out just an observation of mine that I made. I just have to say it. You know it. You feel it. These guys are creepy and, yes, just weird as hell. That's what you see. That's what you see.
Democrats, from former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, praised Kamala Harris for selecting Tim Walz, who's seen by many to be a progressive populist. Walz was elected governor of Minnesota in 2018 after six terms in Congress, where he served as the ranking member of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. A former public school teacher and high school football coach who served 24 years in the National Guard. As governor, Walz has been praised by progressives for signing legislation to codify abortion rights in Minnesota, provide free lunch to public school students and enact new gun control laws. Walz himself is a hunter and gun owner who was once endorsed by the NRA. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro also spoke at the Harris rally in Philadelphia. Shapiro had also been in the running to be Harris's vice presidential pick. In news from Gaza, Israel has ordered Palestinians to leave the Beit Hanun area of Gaza City ahead of what's expected to be a new Israeli offensive. This comes as Israel's war on Gaza enters its 11th month. Meanwhile, Hamas has announced Yahya Sinwar will become the new leader of the group's political wing following Israel's assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran last week. Sinwar has served as Hamas's top leader in Gaza since 2017 and is credited with being the mastermind of the October 7th attack on Israel. One Hamas official told the BBC, quote, "They killed Haniyeh, the flexible person who was open to solutions. Now they have to deal with Sinwar and the military leadership," unquote. The news outlet 972 has revealed the Israeli army has been using Amazon's cloud services to store massive amounts of surveillance information on the population of Gaza. The news outlet also revealed Google and Microsoft have been providing the Israeli military artificial intelligence tools to help in its war on Gaza. A group of United Nations experts have condemned Israel for torturing Palestinians held inside Israeli prisons. In a statement, the experts wrote, quote, "Torture practices are irredeemably unlawful and constitute international crimes, yet form part of the modus operandi of Israel's notorious detention and torture system," they said. The experts went on to write, quote, "These practices are intended to punish Palestinians for resisting occupation and seek to destroy them individually and collectively," unquote. Meanwhile, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has published a major new report documenting how Israel's turned its jails into what B'Tselem calls torture camps. This is Sarit Mikhaeli, B'Tselem's spokesperson.
So firstly, it's important to tell the stories of the victims, of people who have been exposed to horrific abuse in Israel's prison system. Additionally, this publication is meant to change the reality. Therefore, B'Tselem has appealed to all nations and to all relevant institutions, including the International Criminal Court, to intervene, to end this reality and to hold Israeli policymakers accountable for what is going on, for the torture of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prison facilities. Mm-hmm.
Many Palestinians who have survived torture in Israeli prisons have spoken out after their release. This is Moazzaz Obayat, who was held for 9 months in an Israeli prison.
The jail was very, very tough, as you can see in my situation. The proof are in my photos that show me before and after the jail. And that is enough to answer the question. It is an unfair detention, and there is killing, and they torture us with metal sticks. We were subject to all kinds of torture.
In Bangladesh, Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus has been tapped to lead an interim government after mass protests forced Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign and flee to India. Yunus had been a vocal critic of Hasina's government. He's described her departure as Bangladesh's second Liberation Day. Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for pioneering the concept of microlending. Thailand's constitutional court has ordered the disbandment of the country's largest opposition party, claiming it violated election rules by campaigning against a law that outlaws criticism of Thailand's royal family. Some 150 lawmakers with the youth-led Move Forward must now transfer to a new political party. The party had won the most seats in last year's election, but was blocked from taking power. Senior United Nations officials are calling on the global community to do more to help get humanitarian aid into Sudan after a famine was declared in at least one part of the Darfur region following 15 months of war between the Sudanese military and the Rapid Support Forces. Edem Wasarnu of the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs addressed the UN Security Council Tuesday.
When famine happens, it means we are too late. It means we did not do enough. It means we, the international community, have failed. This is an entirely man-made crisis and a shameful stain on our collective conscience.
In St. Louis, Missouri, County Prosecutor Wesley Bell has defeated Congressmember Cori Bush in a closely watched primary. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and its super PAC spent $9 million to take out Bush, who was one of the most progressive lawmakers in Congress. The election comes just weeks after AIPAC helped defeat another progressive, New York Congressmember Jamal Bowman. Bush and Bowman have both been vocal critics of Israel's war on Gaza. During a speech to supporters last night, Congressmember Bush decried the impact of outside money on the race.
This was the second most expensive congressional race in our nation's history. $19 million and counting. And so that's how much they spent in this race. Mostly far-right funded super PACs against the interests of the people of St. Louis, the people of Missouri's first. They sought to divide us.
In California, a group of migrants jailed at two private Immigration and Customs Enforcement jails have relaunched a labor and hunger strike protesting dire conditions and demanding fair wages for detained migrant workers. The hunger strikers are also calling for the end to the excessive use of solitary confinement at the Mesa Verde and Golden State Annex for the facilities to shut down. Many of the detained migrants and asylum seekers are paid only $1 a day to perform janitorial duties and other jobs at the facilities, which are operated by the GEO Group. The hunger strikers have reportedly faced heavy retaliation for taking part in the peaceful protest. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, four hotel workers have been charged with felony murder in connection with the death of Devontae Mitchell, a 43-year-old black father who died on June 30th after security guards pinned him to the ground for over 8 minutes outside a Hyatt Regency hotel. An attorney for Mitchell's family, William Sutton, welcomed the charges, saying, quote, "What caused his death was the fact that four people beat him to death on the sidewalk and jumped on top of him. That's why he's dead," he said. In media news, New York police have arrested Samuel Seligson, a local journalist, and charged him with felony hate crime charges after he filmed pro-Palestinian activists hurling red paint at the homes of top officials at the Brooklyn Museum. Samuel Seligson's lawyer, Lena Whitty, denounced the charges. She said, quote, "Samuel is being charged for alleged behavior that's protected by the First Amendment and consistent with his job as a credentialed member of the press. What's even more concerning, however, is that this member of the press is being charged with a hate crime," unquote. In other news about press freedom, prosecutors in Kansas have announced plans to charge the former police chief in the city of Marion with obstruction of justice for his involvement in a police raid last August targeting the town's local newspaper, the Marion County Record, as well as the home of the paper's publisher, Eric Meyer. His 98-year-old mother, Joan Meyer, who co-owned the newspaper, died of a heart attack a day after the police raided their home. And in Spain, climate activists spray-painted the mansion of the Argentine football star Lionel Messi on the island of Ibiza. The action was led by the group Futura Vegetal, which pointed to a report by Oxfam showing that the wealthiest 1% of the world's population generate the same amount of carbon emissions as the poorest two-thirds of humanity. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk about the first joint rally of the Democratic presidential and vice presidential nominee. Stay with us.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the and then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home.
Perfect Day by Lou Reed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. It's War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris campaigned in Philadelphia Tuesday with Tim Walz, just hours after Harris picked the Minnesota governor to be her running mate. Walz was elected governor of Minnesota in 2018 after six terms in Congress, where he served as the ranking member of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. Walz is a former public school teacher and high school football coach who served 24 years in the National Guard. Harris and Walz spoke Tuesday in front of more than 12,000 people at Temple University, where Walz criticized his Republican rivals Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
Like all regular people I grew up with in the heartland, J.D. studied at Yale, had his career funded by Silicon Valley billionaires, and then wrote a bestseller trashing that community. Come on! That's not what middle America is. And I got to tell you, I can't wait to debate the guy. That is, if he's willing to get off the couch and show up. So, you see what I did there? Look. I gotta tell you, pointing out just an observation of mine that I made. I just have to say it. You know it. You feel it. These guys are creepy and, yes, just weird as hell. That's what you see. Again and again and again, Trump weakens our economy to strengthen his own hand. He mocks our laws. He sows chaos and division. And that's to say nothing of his record as president. He froze in the face of the COVID crisis. He drove our economy into the ground. And make no mistake, violent crime was up under Donald Trump. That's not even counting the crimes he committed.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz speaking as Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris's new running mate at their first campaign appearance together Tuesday evening in Philadelphia. Minnesota's progressive congressmember Ilhan Omar celebrated Walz's selection on Tuesday, writing on X, quote, "Congratulations to our next vice president, Tim Walz. Our North Star state governor has signed universal school meals, paid family and sick leave, marijuana legalization, and protections for reproductive rights into law, bringing Minnesota nice to the ticket," she said. A video from last year has gone viral of Walz signing into law a measure guaranteeing free breakfast and lunch for all the state's public school students. The students embrace Walz and cheer him as he signs. Meanwhile, Tara Nhauska, an indigenous lawyer, activist, and founder of the Gnu Collective, recalled on social media it was Walz who oversaw the 2021 police response to the Stop Line 3 protest, where she was, quote, shot by police with rubber bullets, mace, pepper balls, paid for by Enbridge. She said, "I heard shouts, cries, and gasping, coughing, punctuated by the sound of munitions firing and a huge drill out of a sci-fi movie boring through the river we were there to protect," unquote. A Minnesota judge later dismissed the charges against Line 3 pipeline protesters in the name of climate justice, saying, quote, "to criminalize their behavior would be the crime," unquote. We begin today's show looking at Walz's political record. As governor, Republicans attacked him for waiting too long to deploy the Minnesota National Guard on the protests after the police murder of George Floyd in 2020. Now, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are highlighting how Walz signed into state law access to abortion rights after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Soon we'll speak with Asma Muhammad, co-chair of the Minnesota Uncommitted Delegation, about where Tim Walz stands on Israel-Gaza and pro-Palestinian protests, which reportedly may have helped to shape why he was chosen over Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. But we begin with Branko Marcetic, Jacobin staff writer. His new piece there is headlined, "The Tim Walz Vice VP Pick Shows America's Politics Are Changing." Branko, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out for us who Tim Walz is, the teacher-turned-coach-turned-congressmember, governor, and now VP candidate?
Well, Walz is, in many ways, an unlikely progressive populist. He started out as kind of a somewhat conservative member of Congress. He ran for this Republican seat, very rural, deep red Republican seat. He won it in 2006 in the wave election of that year. He was actually one of the few former military members that have been recruited that year by Democrats to try and win seats that actually succeeded. And he kind of improbably held on to the seat over the years, you know, through several different wave elections that went against Democrats. And he had this somewhat contradictory record. He took conservative positions on things like vetting of refugees and gun rights. He was favored by the NRA for a very long time. But he also voted against the TARP bailout. He was very anti-war. He had a very decent anti-war record. And right up to his time as governor, he very much pushed back against this idea that China is this adversary, that the U.S. cannot have a cooperative relationship with it. And then once he won in 2018, he had run on kind of a somewhat tepid left-of-center program. But as governor, he really, I think looking at what had happened in the political landscape after 2016, the way that things had shifted, the way that progressive policies, investment in human infrastructure had become such a popular thing, he really kind of took that program as his own, and he ran on raising taxes on the rich. He ran on and actually implemented a policy to transition to renewable energy by first 2050. Then he moved that timeline up to 2040. He ran on investing in education and childcare, which in Minnesota was the most expensive in the country often. And then in 2023, when he finally got this Democratic trifecta, or Democratic Farmer Labor Party trifecta in Minnesota, meaning that the Democrats basically controlled the state Senate, the state House, and the governor's mansion, he ended up going full speed ahead and saying, look, we only have one chance to try and get all this done. And that's where you see the flurry of legislation that some of which you mentioned there get passed, in addition to which you would also list things like tuition-free public college for families making under $80,000 a year, banning non-compete clauses for workers, legalizing marijuana, of course, the renewable energy transition bill, and things like banning conversion therapy, a whole host of things, capping payday lenders. It was really one of the most consequential and productive legislative sessions anywhere in the country. And again, it's quite a surprising one, given Walz's background as someone who had not come out of necessarily progressive politics.
And Branko, could you talk a bit about what he did in terms of the wage theft law and reforms to solitary confinement in the state, and a little more about what he did in terms of climate change?
Yeah, I mean, the wage theft law, that was actually something that he had done much earlier in his first term as governor, before he had that trifecta. So one of the interesting things about Walz is that he's someone who, like many Democrats, talks about bipartisanship, consensus, compromise. These are all things that we are used to hearing from Democratic officials. Usually what that means in practice is it's making deals that end up giving a lot of victories to the right. It ends up kind of disappointing the Democratic base. And what ends up happening is that, that the people who make the deals then have to sort of put a gun to the head of the Democratic voters and say, well, look, you have no option but to vote for us anyway. In Walz's case, he was actually able to work with Republicans, not on everything, certainly. A lot of his agenda was blocked when they controlled the state Senate, but he did actually manage to get quite a few things passed with Republican support, including this wage theft bill, which was then considered one of the strongest in the country. It made stealing wages more than $1,000 a felony. On climate, as I said, there was a 2040 renewable transition bill. That's a major thing. However, at the same time, we have to note that, that there were limitations to some of his progressivism on this. The Line 3 pipeline by Enbridge, which you referenced, Amy, that was one of the things that, that Walz, at first, he had sided with environmentalists and moved to suspend it, but in the end, he went ahead with it. And that's considered a big red flag for environmentalists, because as good as it is to set targets for transitioning to renewables, by allowing these pipelines to be built, it locks in potentially decades of carbon emissions. And of course, also serves as a ticking time bomb where these pipelines inevitably end up having leaks or some kind of problem, and they end up poisoning the water and land around them. In terms of criminal justice, again, he would probably be considered to have a mixed record. The right will attack him for a number of different reforms he made in criminal justice. He as you say, he banned solitary confinement in juvenile facilities. He also at first did things like banning certain types of holds by police in schools. He also was very vocally in favor of prosecuting the killers of George Floyd, and he made a number of other reforms, banning warrior training by police and other sort of dangerous trainings there. But at the same time, once some of the energy from 2020 and the streets had kind of gone away and public mood became more concerned with crime, with public safety, that kind of thing, then at that point, Walz kind of did what a lot of Democrats did and became much more of an ardent champion of law enforcement. He still signed certain reforms into law, don't get me wrong, but in the end, he put much more of a focus on putting money into police departments, putting more money into police recruitment. He opposed the Minneapolis ballot measure that would have replaced that city's police department with a public safety department. So, you know, and actually, I mentioned the banning the certain holds in schools. Walz actually ended up folding on that under police pressure, and he ended up actually changing that and repealing it ultimately. So, you know, there's a mixed record there. I think there's things that, that both his critics on the right are going to find things to attack him on, and as well as critics on the left. And I think also critics on the people on the left, progressives, they'll find things that they like about his record on criminal justice, too.
I want to go to an old radio ad for Walz's campaign for Congress back in 2006 that touches on the issue of health care.
Hi, my name is Tim Walz, and I'm running for Congress here in southern Minnesota for several important reasons. But today I'd like to tell you about one issue that's very personal to me. I am a retired command sergeant major in the Minnesota National Guard, and after years of firing artillery, I sustained severe inner ear damage. Because I have good health insurance provided through my employer, I was able to have surgery on my ear. As my ear healed, my hearing was gradually restored. One morning, several weeks after the surgery, I awoke to a sound I couldn't identify. I asked my wife what I was hearing, and she told me, "Tim, that's your 4-year-old daughter, Hope. You see, Hope wakes up singing every morning." But I had never heard that sound until that day. I'm running for Congress because I believe we as a country have a moral obligation to ensure that every father can hear his daughter sing, that every citizen receives the best care our medical community has to offer. I'm Tim Walz, and I approve this message because I've heard how important health care is to everyone.
And this is Tim Walz speaking last night.
In Minnesota, we respect our neighbors and their personal choices that they make. Even if we wouldn't make the same choice for ourselves, there's a golden rule. Mind your own damn business. These guys are after my heart, chanting, mind your own damn business. That feels good, so thank you. Look, that includes IVF, and this gets personal for me and my family. When my wife and I decided to have children, we spent years going through infertility treatments, and I remember praying every night for a call for good news. The pit in my stomach when the phone rang, and the agony when we heard that the treatments hadn't worked. So it wasn't by chance that when we welcomed our daughter into the world, we named her Hope. When Vice President and I talk about freedom, we mean the freedom to make your own healthcare decisions.
Tim Walz has zeroed in on J.D. Vance's previous opposition to a Senate bill that sought to protect access to IVF. Bronco Marchetich, it brings in several issues. It brings in the issue of abortion, and it brings in the issue of health care. He said a Trump-Vance administration would surely overturn the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I mean, I think, number one, those clips speak to his strengths as a communicator. And the issue of abortion has obviously become central to American politics since the overturning of Roe v. Wade. It's in many ways the reason why Walz actually ended up with the trifecta they had in Minnesota, because of the kind of outrage that engendered among Minnesota voters, particularly, you know, any liberal-leaning voters. And that was one of the first bills that he signed, was a codification of abortion rights in Minnesota. And he went out of his way to kind of advertise Minnesota as a sanctuary for people around the country who needed to get abortions but were maybe unable to in their states. He said, you know, you can come here and you will not be prosecuted. We won't work with surrounding states. And obviously, the Democrats are very much hoping that that issue is going to propel the party to another victory in 2024. Trump and the Republicans have had to moderate on it, realizing that this is a massive political liability. Healthcare as well. It's another one of the major cost concerns that Americans feel. I mean, it's been that way for years, but consistently in poll after poll and survey after survey, Americans say that their health care bills, their medical bills that they get, are one of their biggest concerns. Now, the thing that I think that Harris and Walz need to do is actually, beyond just using their own personal histories and kind of framing this in very empathetic language to try and connect with voters, I think they need to offer them real solutions on this stuff. You know, I think something like codifying Roe v. Wade on a national level, that seems like a no-brainer. But I think they also need to present an actual healthcare plan beyond just kind of vague platitudes or simply talking about strengthening the Affordable Care Act. You know, there has to be something done to really make sure that the people are able to get the healthcare they need, that they're not going to be worried about going bankrupt. And I think unless people are given these concrete solutions to the concerns around affordability in their lives, which have been sky high since 2021. You know, I think you can make all the kind of savvy VP picks that you want and all the good speeches, but ultimately it's not going to get people wanting to go out and stand in line and vote for you in November.
Bronco, we only have about a minute. I wanted to ask you, in terms of the conventional wisdom of many Democrats saying that that Kamala Harris choosing Walz instead of Josh Shapiro from a key swing state like Pennsylvania, or Mark Kelly from Arizona, would not add that much to the ticket. What's your sense of that?
I think that's not true. I mean, I think Shapiro was a very risky pick if he had been chosen, not just because of his stance in Israel-Palestine, but because of a number of scandals that were in his background. And the fact that he, in terms of his business friendliness, is wanting to cut corporate tax rates, it was completely out of step with both Harris and where a lot of the American public is. I think there has been a sea change in the American political landscape. It was his record for all the flaws that there are to his record, and believe me, there are definitely many flaws. It's still a very robust progressive record, and in the past that would have been considered a liability. But I think, according to reports, at least, you know, one of the big reasons that Harris chose Walz, one of the things that she saw in him as a viable governing partner, was the fact that he was someone who had done a lot of the things that she wants to do on a national level, and she thought that he could help her do that. And by the way, the things that she wants to do, the things that she's talking about, the things that Walz has already done in Minnesota, if you look at surveys, they're overwhelmingly popular among the American public across partisan lines. So I think, you know, that has been true for a long time, but it's taken a long time for the Democratic Party, for the kind of establishment in Washington to realize it. And so we're seeing these things start to really change before our eyes now.
For more on where the new Democratic vice presidential candidate and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz stands on Israel-Gaza and pro-Palestinian protests, we're joined now by Asma Mohammed, campaign manager for Vote Uncommitted Minnesota. She's the co-chair of the Minnesota Uncommitted Delegation, one of the 11 Minnesota Uncommitted Delegates going to the Democratic National Convention. Asma, welcome to Democracy Now! You're usually in Minnesota, but joining us today from Chicago. What are your governor's positions as you come from Minnesota and he is the governor of Minnesota?
Yeah, Governor Walz has been pretty clear in his support for Israel in the past, and we know that. In the past, he has refused to meet with Palestinian families who want to talk about Gaza. He has refused to divest from Israeli bonds and banks, and we know that. And at the same time, we know that the decision ultimately relies with Kamala Harris. So we don't necessarily want to meet with him, but we do want to meet with the vice president because she's shown a willingness to learn and to move. And we know that Tim Walz has obviously done a little bit of the same, right? He has moved in the NRA. He had an A rating with the NRA, and now he has an F rating with them. So he has shown a willingness to listen to the people. So we are hopeful there. But in the past, he has definitely been a pro-Israel in his governorship.
And Asma, you're one of the 11 Minnesota uncommitted delegates who will be going to the Democratic National Convention. What will you be calling for there?
So as one of the 11 delegates coming from Minnesota, uncommitted, we are pushing for Harris delegates that want a ceasefire to join us in calling for a ceasefire and an arms embargo against Israel. And we want a meeting with Vice President Harris so we can talk to her to get a commitment for an arms embargo and a ceasefire. Because we know right now, going into November, that we cannot win this election without the nearly 1 million voters who voted alongside us during the primaries. During the primaries, 46,000 Minnesotans voted saying that they wanted the war in Gaza to stop. Right. And we know that those people may not even show up to the polls in November. They have no reason to show up if there is no ceasefire and no arms embargo by November. And we want to remind Vice President Harris of that. So we are asking for a meeting at the DNC with her and uncommitted delegates.
Asma Mohammed, I know there's been a demand by the uncommitted movement, uncommitted delegates who are going to be in Chicago at the DNC, for Dr. Tania Hajj Hassan to be able to speak from the stage, one of the many American doctors who have volunteered in Gaza. Is that still a demand? And if you can also talk about what are the plans for the Democratic National Convention?
Absolutely. So Dr. Tania Hajj Hassan, again, is a doctor who went to Gaza and got to see the atrocities firsthand. We just want 5 minutes of her on stage at the DNC to share what she saw with the people at the convention to share with delegates that they have power to push for a ceasefire, and that without an arms embargo, a ceasefire doesn't matter because those are U.S. weapons that we continue to supply. So I think our ask is very clear. We want people to hear from a doctor who has really no political agenda beyond telling people what she witnessed. And then beyond that, we want Harris delegates because, believe it or not, there are Harris delegates who really do support a ceasefire. 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire. And we want to remind the party and the party leadership of that. So we've put an ask out to Jamie Harrison, the chair of the DNC. We've put an ask out to the DNC. And we think that they are amenable to these demands. And we are hopeful that we are going to hear back from the vice president on this.
And Asma, it's hard to say, but what do you feel do you feel that the uncommitted movement had an impact on Kamala Harris and her choice of Tim Walz as a running mate?
I think that the uncommitted movement absolutely had an impact on Kamala Harris choosing Tim Walz because, first things first, we have the largest uncommitted delegation in the country, and Tim Walz had nice things to say about the uncommitted delegation. He pointed out that we were sharing our voices and that our voices should be heard by the candidate. At that time, he had no idea whether or not he was he had no idea that he would ever be considered for a VP because at that time President Biden was still in the running. And so I think that that was a part of it. And the other thing I think that's really important is that Shapiro wasn't kind to protesters. He wasn't kind. He really wasn't supportive of anyone that was talking about Gaza. He had his own, I think, scandals beyond that. And more than anything, I think Tim Walz was like a non-controversial pick. But I do think that we had an influence. And I think that the choice of Walz was made in good faith to show young voters, Muslim voters, people that were really feeling that they were not being heard by the Harris campaign, that here, look, this is for you. It, I think, was a gift for a lot of people that were feeling like, if it's Shapiro, I'm out. I'm done with this campaign. And because of the Walz pick, are feeling a little bit more energized. And I don't think that's the same for everyone, especially for people from Minnesota who have felt, you know, the impact of his pro-Israel policies or felt the impact of the National Guard being called in 2020 or on Line 3 protesters. But I still think that it felt like a non-controversial pick and is a reminder that Kamala Harris is different.
Asma Muhammad, we want to thank you for being with us, campaign manager for Vote Uncommitted Minnesota. And we want to thank Branko Marcetic, Jacobin staff writer. His new piece headlined, "The Tim Walz VP Pick Shows America's Politics Are Changing." Next up, we go to Jeremy Scahill with Dropsite News about his new report, "Something Came from the Outside, an Eyewitness Account of the Aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's Assassination." Stay with us. Dream of Life by Patti Smith. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how the Middle East is bracing for a possible broader regional war after Hamas's top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Tehran and a top Hezbollah commander was assassinated in Beirut last week. Israel took credit for the Beirut strike and has been widely accused of being behind the Haniyeh killing. On Tuesday, Hamas named Yahya Sinwar to be the group's new political leader, replacing Haniyeh. Yahya Sinwar has served as Hamas's top leader in Gaza since 2017, is credited with being the mastermind of the October 7th attack on Israel that killed more than 1,100 people. For more on boiling tensions in the region, we go to Croatia, where we are joined by Jeremy Scahill of Drop Site News. His recent piece is headlined, Something Came from the Outside, an eyewitness account of the aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's assassination. Jeremy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you start off by finding out who you spoke to and what you found out?
Well, Amy, first let's set the scene here. Benjamin Netanyahu, the week before these assassinations, had celebrated his victory tour in the United States, where he not only stood before the U.S. Congress and got repeated standing ovations as though he was on some sort of a bloody, bizarro version, you know, world version of a concert where he was celebrating his genocidal war and receiving generous applause from both Democrats and Republicans. And he not only met with the sitting president, but also Kamala Harris, as well as Donald Trump. And the message that he heard from all three of them was that they were ironclad in their support for what they characterized as Israel's security. Now, there was some difference in how each of those three people interacted with Netanyahu, but the most important thing for people to remember is that all three of them firmly support the bipartisan U.S. policy, which has led to this genocidal, scorched-earth war against the Palestinians of Gaza. So Netanyahu then comes back to Israel immediately greenlights a series of assassinations. You have the killing in Beirut of Fuad Shakur, who was a senior Hezbollah commander, also killed in that strike, we understand, was an Iranian military advisor to Hezbollah. And that was followed just some hours later by the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's political bureau. And Haniyeh had just returned back to a guest residence that is housed within a compound in northern Tehran that is controlled and guarded by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, the most elite military force in the country. I spoke to Dr. Khaled Kadoumi, who is Hamas's senior representative in Tehran and also a member of its Arab and Muslim world outreach division of Hamas. He was on the second floor of this building. You know, they call it a guest house, but it's basically like an apartment complex. And Dr. Kadoumi was on the second floor. Ismail Haniyeh and his bodyguard were on the fourth floor. Dr. Kadoumi described to me how he had not gone to the state dinner, which was held in honor of Iran inaugurating its new president. Ismail Haniyeh was there, as were many leaders from the region. Haniyeh gets back to the guest complex around 11:30. Dr. Kadoumi and others gather with Haniyeh. He says that they were discussing the assassination of Fuad Shakur in Lebanon and what they were assessing might be the regional implications for a broader war and Netanyahu's game plan. And then they retired to their rooms to go to sleep. And Dr. Kadoumi described hearing a massive shaking of the building. And he, you know, was disoriented, woke up, didn't know what it was. He thought at first maybe there had been an earthquake on what he said was a kind of great scale. He gets out of the bedroom and just sees smoke. He discovers that the bathroom walls and part of the ceiling had collapsed in the room where he was. He goes out into the hallway. Other members of the Hamas delegation told him that there had been some sort of a strike on Ismail Haniyeh's apartment. Dr. Kadoumi, who is a medical doctor, ran then up to the fourth floor, and he entered the guest suite where Ismail Haniyeh had been staying, and he discovered the body of Ismail Haniyeh as well as his bodyguard. And he described to me seeing what appeared to be a massive hole in the exterior wall. It also had some windows, but he said it appeared to him as though some sort of a missile or other projectile had crashed into the room from the outside, and that was what had in fact killed Ismail Haniyeh.
And Jeremy, what do you make of the New York Times report that came out a few days later claiming that the explosion was a result of a bomb that had been smuggled into that residence months earlier? And of course, that report was from Ronan Bergman, who is the New York Times reporter probably most closest to Israeli intelligence.
Yeah, Juan, that's correct. You know, Israel has been clearly spinning a narrative. In fact, today, some of the top Israeli propagandists on social media have been pushing more details about this story, and they say that that Mossad was able to co-opt Iranians to go into the guest complex and plant these explosives. And they say that the perpetrators of the bombing of Hania were captured on CCTV. And, you know, Ronan Bergman was the first to report this in the New York Times, and he has a very long history of reporting on Mossad activities. He has close ties to Israeli intelligence. He wrote a book called Rise and Kill First, which is about the history of Israel's assassination program. And really, this narrative is something that is sort of like pulled from the script pages of the series Tehran, the Israeli show about a covert Israeli agent who is operating inside of Iran, trying to take down a nuclear reactor. Now, I should say, in the interest of accuracy and fairness, we don't know exactly what happened there. It is plausible that what is being promoted by the New York Times and Israeli propagandists is largely the truth, that they were able to penetrate the building, that they planted these explosives. The Iranians, though, have pushed back very, very strongly against that. They say that some sort of a projectile hit the building. In fact, Juan, within hours of the explosion inside of Hania's guest suite, Iranian news services were already saying that some sort of a projectile was seen hitting the building. So it's possible that what is being stated about a bomb being planted there is true. The Iranians are pushing back against it. Not just Dr. Kadoumi from Hamas, but other eyewitnesses also described damage to the scene that appears consistent with a missile or a rocket or some sort of projectile hitting it. There's been discussion that Israeli intelligence was able to penetrate either the mobile phone of Ismail Haniyeh or his bodyguard, and that they were able to use tracking malware to pinpoint a precision missile strike against him. There have been reports that Ismail Haniyeh's entire upper body was destroyed, which could either be consistent with a bomb under a bed that exploded or a missile directly hitting him if he was near his phone. So we don't know. What we do know is that the Iranians are in a position to release forensic evidence, presumably in an IRGC compound. They also have video surveillance capabilities. We know that they did have counter-espionage facilities there, as well as radar and presumably counter-missile technology in the area. So either way you slice it, though, this is very bad for Iran because it indicates a security breach. Yes, it would probably be worse if they were able to penetrate the ranks of the IRGC and convert Iranians into agents. But the mere fact that Israel was able to do this assassination on Iranian soil is a very, very bad thing for Iran. And that lends some legitimacy to the fact that they're saying that it was, a missile strike, because even admitting that is very, very bad. But at the end of the day, the Iranians are in the best position to present evidence to the world of what happened. I must say, though, that while this discussion is relevant, how did Israel assassinate the leader of Hamas, the top negotiator, in a process that Joe Biden is claiming is so central, that he wants a ceasefire right now? Every time we talk about this, or what the Israelis have succeeded in doing, is distracting from the fact that the genocide in Gaza continues, that Netanyahu is serving as the chief arsonist in the Middle East, that he's trying to draw the United States into war with Iran, that he's trying to draw the United States into war with Hezbollah. And, for all the talk of Western countries about how Iran needs to show restraint, the truth is, and this is just a fact, it's not politically correct to say it, but it's factual, both Iran and Hezbollah, given what they've been facing, have already shown quite a bit of restraint. And the last time the Iranians responded to the Israelis was when Israel, on April 1st, launched a strike inside of Syria, in Damascus. They bombed the Iranian consulate. They killed a dozen people. About half of them were IRGC personnel. Yes, Iran rained missiles down on Israel and sent, fleets of drones toward Israel, but they did it in a highly telegraphed manner that allowed the United States and other countries to amass a very effective counter-missile defense operation. I believe one person was killed in that Iranian missile strike. So, you know, the devil is often in the details here. It's very clear that Netanyahu has no intention of engaging in a ceasefire. He's going to continue with the genocide in Gaza. And he really wanted to strike not just at Hamas, but in many ways, this was a very bold operation to tell Iran, we can strike whenever and wherever we want against you.
We just have less than a minute, Jeremy, but your response to the latest news that Hamas has chosen Yahya Sinwar to replace Ismail Haniyeh, of course, who was assassinated and was the chief negotiator with Israel around the issue of a ceasefire.
My sources, Amy, have told me, within Hamas, have told me that this was a wartime decision, that they didn't have time to assemble the full Shura Council, and that the only sensible decision they could make was to fully support the on-the-ground commander of the military operations, which right now is Yahya Sinwar. This is also in line with recent polls that have done in the Palestinian occupied territories that indicate that the popularity of Sinwar and Hamas in general are rising as the popularity of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority are going down. It's a statement that they understand Israel wants to fight to quote unquote total victory, and they're going to continue their operations, which they feel have been successful militarily in repelling and causing great harm to the Israeli military.
Jeremy Scaho, we want to thank you so much for being with us of Drop Site News. We'll link to your recent piece headlined Something Came from the Outside, an eyewitness account of the aftermath of Ismail Haniyeh's assassination. Jeremy is former senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today with some very sad news. Today we remember our dear colleague, Samin Farhande. She was the Democracy Now! Education Director for the last 13 years. She died on Monday after a battle with colon cancer. Samin was an award-winning independent producer, lifelong educator and activist. She's survived by her partner of 20 years, Eric Hiltner, and their daughter, Ana Luisa Minu Farhande. We're going to go now to a clip of Samin speaking at the Allied Radio Conference in Detroit before the pandemic about her work at Democracy Now!
We have a broadcast from 8 to 9 live in New York City each day, each weekday, and my job is to do outreach to the education community, to colleges, high schools, middle schools, even elementary, and we have at this time over 1,000 students that come through our studio. So what we do is I talk to the teachers or professors. They will bring their students, so let's say a professor of philosophy or ethics or media studies or a high school that is studying journalism or government. Mm-hmm. Or an English class, a middle school, they will bring their students early in the morning at 7:30. They will we show them our control room. We show them all the crew that's working, the producers, video producers, line producers, technical director, behind the scenes, and then we show them the studio as well. Then they sit down. At 8, the show starts, and they watch in our green room. They watch the show, both from what's going on to the air and also what is happening in the studio. So they see Amy Goodman, they see Juan Gonzalez, and they see the show guests. They watch the show, and after the show, we have a discussion about the show content and really try to demystify and deconstruct how media is made. And also, we talk about the issues, you know. So we talk about how is Democracy Now!, this independent media program, this news program, different from corporate media? How is it different from, say, CNN or ABC News and so forth?
When the pandemic hit in 2020, rather than closing up shop because Samin would shepherd classes through, conduct wide-ranging discussions with fourth graders, with graduate students in journalism, with journalists from other countries who'd come through the United States. But she simply expanded to doing Zoom calls with classes around the world, reaching thousands of students. Samin has been a long-time documentary filmmaker. She was a part of a group from Deep Dish TV and Paper Tiger TV that produced a series back in 1990 and 1991, before the Gulf War started, called the Gulf Crisis TV Project. This is Samin in one of those videos.
This series is made out of material sent to us by people all over the country who are currently speaking out against the U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf. Nationwide, people are raising questions, demanding information, organizing teach-ins, and finding out that they are a part of a major movement focused on peace in the Persian Gulf and the need to solve domestic problems.
Samin is survived by her partner of 20 years, Eric Hiltner, and her daughter, Ana Luisa Minu Fajande, who graduated from Beacon High School just a few weeks ago and now heads to Sarah Lawrence College. Ana Luisa, we will all be there for you now and forever. I used to take long walks with Samin and our little pups, Zazu and Ziggy, through the Lower East Side. She particularly would take me to the gardens that she had fought so hard for, the community gardens of the Lower East Side, of which there are more than 100. Samin will be so sorely missed here at Democracy Now!, but her legacy will inspire so many. Our deepest condolences to Ana Luisa, to Eric, to her dearest friends and community, which is so large, which is global. Samin taught at Hampshire College, at the School of Visual Arts, as her work appeared at the Whitney and so many other places. Samin, your life has had so much meaning and will continue to. Samin Minu Luisa Mafarkande Presente. That does it for our show. We thank everyone for being there for Samin and for Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. We need to democratize American democracy.
That's Stephen Levitsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Levitsky on tyranny of the minority. The United States is moving toward a multiracial society, but that demographic development has sparked an authoritarian political backlash. Powerful forces like things just the way they are. Our political system makes the U.S. vulnerable to minority rule. Perhaps the most undemocratic mechanism enabling minority rule is the antiquated Electoral College. No other country has one. The Electoral College has given the presidency to a candidate that received fewer votes multiple times. Most recently, in 2016. Donald Trump was elected president, even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It almost happened again in 2020, where a shift of a few thousand votes would have given the White House to Trump, even though Joe Biden got 7 million more votes. Our guest today is Stephen Levitsky. He's professor of government at Harvard. He's the co-author of How Democracies Die and Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in December 2023. And now, Stephen Levitsky.
The United States is experiencing what regime scholars call democratic backsliding. All leading global democracy indices register a decline for the United States since 2016 or 17. Just to take one example, Freedom House has a global freedom index, which scores all countries annually from a low of zero, North Korea, to a high of 100. A decade ago, the United States received a score of 92 out of 100, which put the U.S. roughly on par with the U.K., Japan, Canada, Germany. Today, the U.S. score is 83. That's tied with Romania and below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to you, but when you have widespread efforts to make it harder to vote, when you have violent threats against election workers and elected officials, and when you have an attempt by an incumbent president to overturn an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. Political scientists have discovered two seemingly rock-solid facts about democracies. First of all, rich democracies never die. The wealthiest democracies ever to break down, Argentina and Hungary, both had a per capita GDP of about $17,000 in today's dollars. The U.S. is four times richer than that. Second seemingly rock-solid fact about democracies is that old democracies never die. No